Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm welcome for Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. General Shelton, I think I'm going to keep you. President Clinton, Vice President Gore, Secretary Albright, and National Security Advisor Berger, and distinguished guests. We are very honored to have with us today the President of the United States to attend this meeting at the Pentagon. He is a Commander-in-Chief with a clear and consistent vision of America's role in the world, and who is shaping the 21st century by his words and his policies. The leadership of our President, our Vice President, the leadership of the military commanders who are with us today, and the service and the sacrifice of the men and women whom they lead, all combine to give us the freedom that we enjoy as a nation. But with that freedom comes responsibility. And the true test of American character is not only how we approach our responsibilities in an era of peace and prosperity, but the courage and conviction we display in times of confrontation and crisis. And so in this world of change and challenge, America, the sole superpower and beacon of freedom, must continue to lead, to project American power, to protect American interests, and above all, to protect and defend our nation. Today, we can still hope that a peaceful diplomatic solution can be found with Iraq, a solution that allows free, unfettered access for the UNSCOM inspections. This is a solution that is preferred by the United States, by the world community, and surely by our allies in the Arabian Gulf. But Iraq must understand that our patience is not infinite, and at some point we will have to act to reduce the menace posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and to reduce Iraq's ability to threaten its neighbors. As the President has focused very intensely on this crisis, no one has stood closer to him than Vice President Al Gore. Vice President Gore appreciates the special role that the United States plays in the Middle East and throughout the world, and he has a profound understanding of the unique strengths of our nation's commitment to freedom and the sacrifices that our young men and women must bear to secure that freedom. He's been a firm and steady hand in our nation's foreign diplomacy in virtually every corner of the world, and his counsel has always been a tremendous help to President Clinton, whether we are patiently pursuing a course of diplomacy or prudently exercising our military power. And his deep knowledge of and commitment to the national security issues go back many years to when we both served in the United States Senate and spent countless hours working together on arms control and other issues that protect the security of our country and promote the interests of the men and women who serve in our forces. Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to introduce my friend, the Vice President of the United States, Al Gore.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And Mr. Secretary, thank you very much for your kind words and for our friendship over the years. We served on the Senate Armed Services Committee together, along with others like Senator Warner and Senator Levin, who accompanied the Secretary of Defense on his recent diplomatic journey. We're pleased to be joined here today by Senator Robb, Congressman Skelton. I want to say how pleased and honored I am to be here with the President and with Secretary Cohen, with the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, with the National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger, with Erskine Bowles, the President's Chief of Staff, and George Tenet, the Director of Central Intelligence, with Secretary Slater of the Transportation Department, Deputy Secretary John Hamry here at the Defense Department and others, and especially with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with our Chairman General Shelton, with General Zinni and others who have been so deeply involved in the matters about which the President was briefed just a short time ago. And let me say it is a special privilege to be with so many of the extraordinary men and women of our armed forces. Thank you so much for your service to the nation. We know the sacrifices that you and your families make every single day, and our nation is grateful to you. Our nation's interests are in extremely good hands, because never before has the world seen a fighting force better trained, better equipped, or better prepared than the fighting force of the United States of America right now. Almost exactly 7 years ago, our soldiers were called upon to once again show the world just what they could do in the deserts of Iraq when Saddam's forces surrendered to our allied coalition and Kuwaiti citizens once again proudly proclaimed their independence from Saddam's tyranny. Since then, of course, in Haiti and Rwanda and Bosnia, in Europe, Korea, and beyond, every hour of every day and night, on land, in the air, and at sea, our troops have served our nation with tremendous courage and effectiveness. And now, once again, the international community faces a serious challenge in the Persian Gulf, a challenge that has engaged the very best of our diplomatic skills and could once again test the might and mettle of our armed forces. There should be no doubt Saddam's ability to produce and deliver weapons of mass destruction poses a grave threat to the peace of that region and the security of the world. His defiance of the will of the international community to allow UNSCOM to do its job cannot and will not be tolerated. And for that reason, over the last several months, President Clinton and his team, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, along with the support of leaders in our Congress such as Senator Lott and Senator Daschle, Speaker Gingrich and Leader Gephardt, Senator Robb and Congressman Skelton and their colleagues in both chambers of the Congress, with the support of all these individuals, the President and his team have been pursuing every possible diplomatic solution to this problem. And even now, we're working around the clock to pursue a possible diplomatic solution and to ensure that the international community is united in the face of Saddam's threats. Saddam should never doubt the will of the American people, their legislators, their military, or their commander-in-chief to protect our interests, defend our security, and ensure the well-being of our fellow citizens and that of our friends and allies around the world. He should know that when it comes to protecting our vital national interests, Americans will stand as one. We will speak as one. And whenever necessary, we will act as one. And now it is my great honor to present to you the man whose leadership and commitment to our nation's security and strength have done so much for the cause of peace and freedom around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, the Commander-in-Chief and President of the United States of America, William Jefferson Clinton.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Sidney. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please be seated. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President, for your remarks and your leadership. Thank you, Secretary Cohen, for the superb job you have done here at the Pentagon and on this most recent very difficult problem. Thank you, General Shelton, for being the right person at the right time. Thank you, General Ralston and the members of the Joint Chiefs, General Zinni, Secretary Albright, Secretary Slater, DCI Tenant, Mr. Bowles, Mr. Berger, Senator Robb, thank you for being here, and Congressman Skelton, thank you very much, and for your years of service to America and your passionate patriotism, both of you. And to the members of our armed forces and others who work here to protect our national security. I have just received a very fine briefing from our military leadership on the status of our forces in the Persian Gulf. Before I left the Pentagon, I wanted to talk to you and all those whom you represent, the men and women of our military. You, your friends, and your colleagues are on the front lines of this crisis in Iraq. I want you, and I want the American people, to hear directly from me what is at stake for America in the Persian Gulf, what we are doing to protect the peace, the security, the freedom we cherish, why we have taken the position we have taken. I was thinking as I sat up here on the platform of the slogan that the First Lady gave me for her project on the millennium, which was remembering the past and imagining the future. Now, for that project, that means preserving the Star Spangled Banner and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and it means making an unprecedented commitment to medical research and to get the best of the new technology. But that's not a bad slogan for us when we deal with more sober, more difficult, more dangerous matters. Those who have questioned the United States in this moment, I would argue, are living only in the moment. They have neither remembered the past nor imagined the future. So first, let's just take a step back and consider why meeting the threat posed by Saddam Hussein is important to our security in the new era we are entering. This is a time of tremendous promise for America. The superpower confrontation has ended. On every continent, democracy is securing for more and more people the basic freedoms we Americans have come to take for granted. Bit by bit, the information age is chipping away at the barriers, economic, political, and social, that once kept people locked in and freedom and prosperity locked out. But for all our promise, all our opportunity, people in this room know very well that this is not a time free from peril, especially as a result of reckless acts of outlaw nations and an unholy axis of terrorists, drug traffickers, and organized international criminals. We have to defend our future from these predators of the 21st century. They feed on the free flow of information and technology. They actually take advantage of the freer movement of people, information, and ideas. And they will be all the more lethal if we allow them to build arsenals of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons and the missiles to deliver them. We simply cannot allow that to happen. There is no more clear example of this threat than Saddam Hussein's Iraq. His regime threatens the safety of his people, the stability of his region, and the security of all the rest of us. I want the American people to understand first the past. How did this crisis come about? And I want them to understand what we must do to protect the national interest and indeed the interest of all freedom-loving people in the world. Remember, as a condition of the ceasefire after the Gulf War, the United Nations demanded, not the United States, the United Nations demanded, and Saddam Hussein agreed to declare within 15 days, this is way back in 1991, within 15 days, his nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons and the missiles to deliver them, to make a total declaration. That's what he promised to do. The United Nations set up a special commission of highly trained international experts called UNSCOM to make sure that Iraq made good on that commitment. We had every good reason to insist that Iraq disarm. Saddam had built up a terrible arsenal, and he had used it. Not once, but many times in a decade-long war with Iran, he used chemical weapons against combatants, against civilians, against a foreign adversary, and even against his own people. And during the Gulf War, Saddam launched Scuds against Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Bahrain. Now, instead of playing by the very rules he agreed to at the end of the Gulf War, Saddam has spent the better part of the past decade trying to cheat on this solemn commitment. Consider just some of the facts. Iraq repeatedly made false declarations about the weapons that it had left in its possession after the Gulf War. When UNSCOM would then uncover evidence that gave lie to those declarations, Iraq would simply amend the reports. For example, Iraq revised its nuclear declarations four times within just 14 months, and it has submitted six different biological warfare declarations, each of which has been rejected by UNSCOM. In 1995, Hussein Kamel, Saddam's son-in-law and the chief organizer of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, defected to Jordan. He revealed that Iraq was continuing to conceal weapons and missiles and the capacity to build many more. Then and only then did Iraq admit to developing numbers of weapons in significant quantities and weapon stocks. Previously, it had vehemently denied the very thing it just simply admitted once Saddam Hussein's son-in-law defected to Jordan and told the truth. Now listen to this. What did it admit? It admitted, among other things, an offensive biological warfare capability, notably 5,000 gallons of botulinum, which causes botulism, 2,000 gallons of anthrax, 25 biological-filled Scud warheads, and 157 aerial bombs. And I might say, UNSCOM inspectors believe that Iraq has actually greatly understated its production. As if we needed further confirmation, you all know what happened to his son-in-law when he made the untimely decision to go back to Iraq. Next, throughout this entire process, Iraqi agents have undermined and undercut UNSCOM. They've harassed the inspectors, lied to them, disabled monitoring cameras, literally spirited evidence out of the back doors of suspect facilities as inspectors walked through the front door, and our people were there observing it and had the pictures to prove it. Despite Iraq's deceptions, UNSCOM has nevertheless done a remarkable job. Its inspectors, the eyes and ears of the civilized world, have uncovered and destroyed more weapons of mass destruction capacity than was destroyed during the Gulf War. This includes nearly 40,000 chemical weapons, more than 100,000 gallons of chemical weapons agents, 48 operational missiles, 30 warheads specifically fitted for chemical and biological weapons, and a massive biological weapons facility at Al-Hakim equipped to produce anthrax and other deadly agents. Over the past few months, as they have come closer and closer to rooting out Iraq's remaining nuclear capacity, Saddam has undertaken yet another gambit to thwart their ambition. By imposing debilitating conditions on the inspectors and declaring key sites which have still not been inspected off limits, including, I might add, one palace in Baghdad, more than 2,600 acres large. By comparison, when you hear all this business about presidential sites reflect our sovereignty, why do you want to come into a residence? The White House complex is 18 acres. So you'll have some feel for this. One of these presidential sites is about the size of Washington, D.C. That's about, how many acres did you tell me it was? 40,000 acres. We're not talking about a few rooms here with delicate personal matters involved. It is obvious that there is an attempt here, based on the whole history of this operation since 1991, to protect whatever remains of his capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction, the missiles to deliver them, and the feedstocks necessary to produce them. The UNSCOM inspectors believe that Iraq still has stockpiles of chemical and biological munitions, a small force of Scud-type missiles, and the capacity to restart quickly its production program and build many, many more weapons. Now, against that background, let us remember the past here. It is against that background that we have repeatedly and unambiguously made clear our preference for a diplomatic solution. The inspection system works. The inspection system has worked in the face of lies, stonewalling, obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. The people who have done that work deserve the thanks of civilized people throughout the world. It has worked. That is all we want. And if we can find a diplomatic way to do what has to be done, to do what he promised to do at the end of the Gulf War, to do what should have been done within 15 days. Within 15 days of the agreement at the end of the Gulf War. If we can find a diplomatic way to do that, that is by far our preference. But to be a genuine solution, and not simply one that glosses over the remaining problem, a diplomatic solution must include or meet a clear, immutable, reasonable, simple standard. Iraq must agree, and soon, to free, full, unfettered access to these sites anywhere in the country. There can be no dilution or diminishment of the integrity of the inspection system that UNSCOM has put in place. Now, those terms are nothing more or less than the essence of what he agreed to at the end of the Gulf War. The Security Council, many times since, has reiterated this standard. If he accepts them, force will not be necessary. If he refuses or continues to invade his obligations through more tactics of delay and deception, he and he alone will be to blame for the consequences. I ask all of you to remember the record here. What he promised to do within 15 days of the end of the Gulf War, what he repeatedly refused to do, what we found out in 95, what the inspectors have done against all odds. We have no business agreeing to any resolution of this that does not include free, unfettered access to the remaining sites by people who have integrity and proven competence in the inspection business. That should be our standard. That's what UNSCOM has done, and that's why I have been fighting for it so hard. That's why the United States should insist upon it. Now, let's imagine the future. What if he fails to comply and we fail to act? Or we take some ambiguous third route, which gives him yet more opportunities to develop this program of weapons of mass destruction and continue to press for the release of the sanctions and continue to ignore the solemn commitments that he made. Well, he will conclude that the international community has lost its will. He will then conclude that he can go right on and do more to rebuild an arsenal of devastating destruction. And someday, some way, I guarantee you, he'll use the arsenal. And I think every one of you who's really worked on this for any length of time believes that too. Now, we have spent several weeks building up our forces in the Gulf and building a coalition of like-minded nations. Our force posture would not be possible without the support of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, the GCC states, and Turkey. Other friends and allies have agreed to provide forces, bases, or logistical support, including the United Kingdom, Germany, Spain and Portugal, Denmark and the Netherlands, Hungary and Poland and the Czech Republic, Argentina, Iceland, Australia, New Zealand, and our friends and neighbors in Canada. That list is growing. Not because anyone wants military action, but because there are people in this world who believe the United Nations resolution should mean something, because they understand what UNSCOM has achieved, because they remember the past, and because they can imagine what the future will be, depending on what we do now. If Saddam rejects peace and we have to use force, our purpose is clear. We want to seriously diminish the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program. We want to seriously reduce his capacity to threaten his neighbors. I am quite confident from the briefing I have just received from our military leaders that we can achieve the objective and secure our vital strategic interests. Let me be clear. A military operation cannot destroy all the weapons of mass destruction capacity, but it can and will leave him significantly worse off than he is now in terms of the ability to threaten the world with these weapons or to attack his neighbors. And he will know that the international community continues to have the will to act if and when he threatens again. Following any strike, we will carefully monitor Iraq's activities with all the means at our disposal. If he seeks to rebuild his weapons of mass destruction, we will be prepared to strike him again. The economic sanctions will remain in place until Saddam complies fully with all UN resolutions. Consider this. Already, these sanctions have denied him $110 billion. Imagine how much stronger his armed forces would be today, how many more weapons of mass destruction operations he would have hidden around the country if he had been able to spend even a small fraction of that amount for a military rebuilding. We will continue to enforce a no-fly zone from the southern suburbs of Baghdad to the Kuwait border and in northern Iraq, making it more difficult for Iraq to walk over Kuwait again or threaten the Kurds in the north. Now, let me say to all of you here, as all of you know, the weightiest decision any president ever has to make is to send our troops into harm's way. And force can never be the first answer, but sometimes it's the only answer. You are the best prepared, best equipped, best trained fighting force in the world. And should it prove necessary for me to exercise the option of force, your commanders will do everything they can to protect the safety of all the men and women under their command. No military action, however, is risk-free. I know that the people we may call upon in uniform are ready. The American people have to be ready as well. Dealing with Saddam Hussein requires constant vigilance. We have seen that constant vigilance pays off, but it requires constant vigilance. Since the Gulf War, we have pushed back every time Saddam has posed a threat. When Baghdad plotted to assassinate former President Bush, we struck hard at Iraq's intelligence headquarters. When Saddam threatened another invasion by massing his troops in Kuwait along the Kuwaiti border in 1994, we immediately deployed our troops, our ships, our planes, and Saddam backed down. When Saddam forcefully occupied Erbil in northern Iraq, we broadened our control over Iraq's skies by extending the no-fly zone. But there is no better example, again I say, than the UN weapons inspection system itself. Yes, he has tried to thwart it in every conceivable way, but the discipline, determination, year-in, year-out effort of these weapons inspectors is doing the job, and we seek to finish the job. Let there be no doubt, we are prepared to act. But Saddam Hussein could end this crisis tomorrow simply by letting the weapons inspectors complete their mission. He made a solemn commitment to the international community to do that and to give up his weapons of mass destruction a long time ago now. One way or the other, we are determined to see that he makes good on his own promise. Saddam Hussein's Iraq reminds us of what we learned in the 20th century and warns us of what we must know about the 21st. In this century, we learn through harsh experience that the only answer to aggression and illegal behavior is firmness, determination, and when necessary, action. In the next century, the community of nations may see more and more of the very kind of threat Iraq poses now, a rogue state with weapons of mass destruction, ready to use them or provide them to terrorists, drug traffickers, or organized criminals who travel the world among us unnoticed. If we fail to respond today, Saddam and all those who would follow in his footsteps will be emboldened tomorrow by the knowledge that they can act with impunity, even in the face of a clear message from the United Nations Security Council and clear evidence of a weapons of mass destruction program. But if we act as one, we can safeguard our interests and send a clear message to every would-be tyrant and terrorist that the international community does have the wisdom and the will and the way to protect peace and security in a new era. That is the future I ask you all to imagine. That is the future I ask our allies to imagine. If we look at the past and imagine that future, we will act as one together, and we still have, God willing, a chance to find a diplomatic resolution of this. And if not, God willing, the chance to do the right thing for our children and grandchildren. Thank you very much.
Speaking at the Pentagon, President Clinton said Iraq must agree and must agree soon to allow free, full, and unfettered inspections anywhere in the country or the United States is prepared to act. You're listening to live coverage of President Clinton's address at the Pentagon on National Public Radio. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With me here in the studio are NPR diplomatic correspondent Ted Clark and NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore. Dan, first of all, the president set out to explain the past and in the context of the past and the future why it is important for the United States to make a stand against Saddam Hussein. Do you think he achieved his purpose?
Yes, I think he did. I think there were three questions on the minds of Americans, certainly on the minds of those who listened to him. One of the questions was why, which I think he answered quite eloquently. But the other questions are when and what. All we know is that he's prepared to use force. These are the generalizations that we have heard before. But for what Congress and to some extent the American people would like to know, these questions of when do you know when you've succeeded, how do you know you've succeeded, when is the end game, how often do you have to do it, these remain unanswered. And I suspect that at the town meeting tomorrow in Columbus and in succeeding days, those questions will also have to be addressed.
Ted Clark, in terms of the future, the president also said some things that we may not have heard quite so specifically laid out as before. If the United States attacks, he said, we cannot destroy all of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destructions, but we can and will leave him significantly worse off. We had heard things along those lines before. And he will know of the international community's willingness to act again. He said the United States would continue to monitor the situation in Iraq, would be prepared to strike again, and that the sanctions would remain in force, as would the no-fly zones in Iraq.